And joining us on Perspectives today is Jeff Shara. Jeff is the New York Times bestselling author, and a lot of people know Jeff because of his historic war novels, especially the Civil War. Gods and Generals was a big movie and a big book, and there are a lot of stories that Jeff has written about. But first of all, I'd like to introduce you and thank you very much for being with us, Jeff. I got carried away there.
That's all right. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You tell us about, in one of your books, I think it's Killer Angels, you talk about how your dad took you to Gettysburg in 1963 and that he was walking with you and he was a great storyteller and that you just listened. And I would imagine, you know, that I would be listening as well with all these stories coming to life, these heroes. And he actually brought those characters to life. And tell us what you remember from that trip with your father.
Well, I remember, first of all, we went to Gettysburg as tourists. I mean, just like many people do now. I mean, there was no expectation of finding a story. We weren't digging deeply into the history or anything like that. We were just simply tourists. And something happened to my father there as he began walking the ground. He was a storyteller all his life. I mean, he was a writer all his life and a master storyteller. He knew a good story when he saw one. And going around Gettysburg, anybody who goes there, I think, gets a sense of that. Well, he became obsessed with telling that story. It took him 7 years to write The Killer Angels. But for me, I mean, I remember vividly the emotion of the place and being caught up because, again, my father was not a historian. I am not a historian. It's not about academics or writing textbooks. It's about telling the story of the people. And it was the people that you become very emotional about as you get to know them. And that's really the thing that I've done all the way through all the books I've written is focus on the characters. Find these interesting people to tell us the story. My job, as I see it, is to take you back with me, just like my father did in The Killer Angels, take you back to the field, to the ground, put you in the heads of these people, and tell you the story the way they would tell it. And I've tried to do that through every one of my stories.
Now, as you mentioned, your father, it took him several years to write the story, and then getting it published was another story in itself. But then finally, it was published. But as you mentioned, with everything that was going on, people really didn't want to read a story about the war.
Well, exactly. I mean, The Killer Angels, I mean, it's funny because today, I mean, a lot of people that have come to this book, say, recently, consider it the classic Civil War novel. The book was published in 1974, after, 41 years ago, after having been turned down by 15 publishers. But then the book finally comes out with this sort of small independent publisher. It wins the Pulitzer Prize in 1975, which shocks everybody, including my father. But then the book never sells, because if you think about 1975, end of the Vietnam War. That subject matter, I mean, the Civil War was about as out of fashion as any subject you can imagine, and so nobody bought the book. Well, that was a bitter disappointment to my father. He went on to write other things. A lot of people always ask me, what other historical works did Michael Shara write? And the answer is none, because there was no audience for it. He died in 1988, never having seen his book become successful. And it was only 5 years later, when the movie Gettysburg came out, which was based on The Killer Angels, that the book became a number one bestseller, something he didn't live to see.
And when you talk about the book and then becoming a movie, it took a lot of knocking on doors to get that movie published or produced. And finally, it was a man we all know and very media-wise, and that is Ted Turner, correct?
Yeah, Ted Turner took an enormous risk. I mean, Ted has ancestry who fought in the Civil War. He's very interested in the subject. He discovered The Killer Angels, discovered that, efforts were being made to make a film, and he financed it. And, I mean, he spent $22 million of his own money, which is a huge risk, because he believed in the project, and he was right. I mean, the film was enormously successful. It's still today. DVDs of the film are available, and they sell like crazy. He did very well with that. And that really sort of validated what my father had always believed, which is that he had created something of a masterpiece, and it seemed like nobody cared. Once Ted put that book on film, everybody cared. And again, the book became a number one bestseller, was enormously successful. Unfortunately, my father wasn't around to enjoy that.
We are visiting with Jeff Shara, New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author, and his latest book is The Fateful Lightning, which is what I understand is the last book in the Civil War.
Well, what I did is it's the fourth and final book of a series dealing with the Civil War in the West. Now, West means different things to different people. And what we're talking about is the first three. You have Shiloh, Vicksburg, and then Chattanooga. The fourth book, The Fateful Lightning, takes place from Atlanta through the end of the war in the Carolinas. Now, to a lot of people, that doesn't sound like the West. But to Civil War people, the East is Virginia. And I got away from, when I followed my father's book with two books sort of creating a trilogy around the Killer Angels. You mentioned Gods and Generals. Gods and Generals is the prequel to the Killer Angels, and The Last Full Measure was the sequel. But that takes all of that's in Virginia. And so I got all these letters from people in Mississippi and Tennessee who said, you know, we're awfully tired of hearing about Robert E. Lee in Virginia. There's an awful lot of stuff that happens west of the Appalachian Mountains that nobody ever talks about. And so I thought it would be fun to do a series. I expected it to be three books. I ended up expanding it to four because there was just too much history to cover. But the one character who winds his way through all four of these books is William Tecumseh Sherman. I love the character of Sherman. And, some people don't like the character of Sherman at all, and I've run into some of that. But at the end of the day, it's a really, really good story to tell.
Well, I would imagine that, you know, people who do not like him or care about him are people who, I guess, have ancestors that they remember from books or stories about the march and the burning. But a lot of people do like him because of the way he was portrayed, the way if you've read anything about him, that he was a very no-nonsense guy, but his men loved him, and they called him, Uncle Billy?
Exactly. And not only that, I mean, just from a historical point of view, what Sherman brings to the equation when you start talking about the Civil War, this is a man who understands how to win a war. Up until that point, if you think about, 4 years of the Civil War, the horrible bloodshed, the cost in human life, a lot of generals knew how to fight battles. A lot of generals knew how to win battles. What they didn't know how to do was win the war. And so the war dragged on far longer, maybe, than it should have. What Sherman brings to the equation is he understands the concept of total war. If you're going to win, if you're going to fight this thing, everybody on the other side has to hurt. You have to, that's what war is. You can't, it's not a gentleman's spat, which is what a lot of people, when the war starts, there are a lot of people who sort of have that old-fashioned idea of what a war is, like two men facing off in a duel, and everything's very gentlemanly. And, by the end of the war, that's all gone. That's out the window. Sherman understands, no, there's nothing gentlemanly about this. This is about winning, and this is about hurting the other side, and he does it very well.
It's interesting the way, when you were writing about General Grant, Tecumseh Grant, in The Fateful Lightning, when he's chewing on that cigar and rolling it on his tongue. I mean, everything just, you can imagine that. You can almost feel, sticking a cigar in your mouth and rolling it around in your tongue. But when he's questioning the war and what's happening, and, he says, well, maybe like my wife, it's the Almighty, but why would the Almighty take little children? Because he had just lost a child, correct?
Yeah, terrible tragedy, and actually two tragedies in Sherman's life is during the war, he loses two of his sons. His son Willie, who's 9 years old, this is right after the Vicksburg campaign in 1863. Willie dies of a typhoid fever, and Willie is beloved by the Army. He's like a mascot. I mean, they make him an honorary sergeant, and the soldiers just love him, and Willie dies, and that's a huge tragedy, not just for Sherman himself, but for for the Army, for the soldiers who love the boy. When Sherman's on his march to the sea, he finds out when he leaves Atlanta and cuts off all his communication, the last thing he hears from his wife, Ellen, is that his infant son, Charles, is ill. I mean, that's all he knows. He's never seen Charles. When he gets to Savannah, and once again the communication lines open, one of the first pieces of communication Sherman receives is that young Charles has died. So that's his second son now to die during the war. And, of course, the tragedy, it's a tragedy anyway, but the tragedy for Sherman is he's never even seen his baby. And the child is gone. And that's, you know, as much emotion as Sherman brings to the fight and the sort of taking the war to the enemy, there's also an enormous amount of emotion in this man for his own children and for his own family. And you realize that what Sherman has wanted all along is to end the war. And that's true of Grant. It's true of, you know, some people in the South. They just want to go home. They want this thing. It's gone on for 4 years. Let's get it over with. Now Sherman is facing these terrible tragedies. He knows his wife, Ellen, is dealing with this on her own up in Ohio. So, yes, it's a very difficult situation. And again, what you mentioned in bringing this up, this is the three-dimensional part of the story. It's not just a war book. It's the story of these characters.
We're visiting with award-winning New York Times bestselling author Jeff Shara. He has just written a book, The Faithful Lightning. It is the fourth, and it's a novel of the Civil War. And as he mentioned, this is the Civil War from the West, and then there are the other books that deal with Civil War from the East. And as Jeff mentioned, we're not talking about the West like Dodge City or El Paso or anything like that, but we are talking about Virginia and Tennessee. And what's interesting in one of, I think it's in The Killer Angels, perhaps, that James Garfield, one of the generals there, and, you know, he goes on to become our 20th president. But it was interesting how many presidents and leaders and key people in history were fighting in the U.S.-Mexico War and got out of West Point, and then they were fighting each other during the Civil War. And then later on, they go on and make a name for themselves in other things.
Well, one reason when I was researching Gods and Generals, and I'm doing my first research, really digging into the lives of these people, and I rely on memoirs, diaries, collections of letters, and in the case of many of these Civil War generals, who, of course, we know very well, these names that are, you know, every student of the Civil War knows, I discovered almost every one of them talks about their experience in Mexico. I knew nothing about the Mexican War. I think most Americans don't. We don't learn it in school. And I went back and started looking and realized, as much as what you said, these generals in the 1860s, back in the 1840s, they're young lieutenants right out of West Point. They know nothing about life, nothing about war. And they go to Mexico, and they enter into this fight against Santa Anna, a man who's very familiar to most Mexican historians, and they're fighting side by side. I mean, these are people who in the 1860s are wearing blue or gray fighting each other. Well, in Mexico, they're on the same side. They're fighting under a man named Winfield Scott, who is a fabulous character. This is the man, the old man of the Army, who teaches these young lieutenants, people like Ulysses Grant, who teaches them how to be soldiers. And I love Robert E. Lee as a primary character in that book. The book is called Gone for Soldiers. Robert E. Lee is a 40-year-old engineer who's never seen combat. And, you know, to write the scene the first time Lee hears a musket ball whistle by his ear was fun for me because, of course, in the Civil War, he's hearing all kinds of musket balls. I mean, that becomes normal. But it's a very different experience, and it's a very different story. And again, most people simply don't know. I really enjoy that.
And in that book and in that war, as you mentioned, the Lieutenant Lee and Lieutenant Grant play vital roles in that war, and especially Lee.
Well, yes. I mean, Lee is on the staff of Winfield Scott. I mean, Lee's an engineer. He's been trained at West Point to be an engineer, and he's in charge of building bridges and fixing roads and things like that. But he becomes, almost by default, he becomes a scout for Winfield Scott. And so he goes out into places where nobody goes, and he to keep an eye on the Mexican army, to keep an eye on Santa Anna's troops. And he has some magnificent experiences. I mean, when I say magnificent, from the point of view of a storyteller, I mean, it's a really good story. Some of the fixes that he gets himself into and some of the things he accomplishes. And he also makes enormous friends with Winfield Scott. And Scott, you know, you think of in the Civil War, Lee is the old man. And you have the young soldiers, Stonewall Jackson, Jeb Stuart, people like that, who, you know, Lee is their mentor. In 1847, it's the other way around. Lee is the young, you know, eager student, and Winfield Scott is the mentor. It's a completely different story.
We're visiting with Jeff Shara, a New York Times bestselling author and award-winning author. He is best known for the Civil War books that he has, but he has also written 4 books on World War II and 1 on the Mexican-American War, 2 on the Revolution, American Revolution, and 1 on World War I. Let's talk a little bit about the World War II, because a lot of anniversaries happened in 2015, the end of the Civil War, the end of World War II, and the books that you wrote for World War II, as you mentioned in your intros to those books, you talk about the fact that it's impossible to write a book without using any profanity when you're around people like George Patton. Also, the fact that you're telling this, it's not just history, but you're telling the story through these men, and not just the officers, but also the guys out in the foxholes and everything else.
Well, when I got to the 20th century, when I started doing World War I and then into World War II, I realized that to tell a story just from the points of view of the generals doesn't work anymore, because the generals are all back there. I mean, they're 10 miles behind the lines. You need that kid. You need the guy out front, you know, with the rifle in his hand. And so I began to include those kinds of characters in the story. And again, these are real people. I mean, because there's a wonderful wealth of riches in terms of memoirs and information. And of course, I also had living veterans to talk to for the World War II series. You know, you mentioned the profanity. It's interesting because my feeling is, if I can't tell you a story without putting in graphic profanity, then I'm not a very good writer. And I know there are people who do that for shock value or what. I prefer not to do that. Now, I'm not a prude, and certainly there is some profanity in these books, but it's appropriate. It's appropriate to the characters. It's appropriate, and you know, to the time and certainly to their experiences, what they're going through. But I don't, and I will just tell you, I never use F-bombs. I just won't do that in any of my stories. I know my books are used in high schools, and I don't want a high school teacher to be uncomfortable with that. So if you want to call that self-editing, well, maybe so. But again, if I can't tell you the story without having to resort to that, and if I can't tell you a story that impacts you, the reader, then I'm not a very good writer.
You know, it's interesting you said that, Jeff, because when I was in undergraduate school at New Mexico State University, I had a chance to spend some time with Red Skelton, and he told me if you can't tell a joke or be funny without using profanity, then you're not very funny.
Exactly. And I even Jerry Seinfeld has said something very similar to that. I mean, exactly. You don't have to rely on that to be funny.
Jeff, you mentioned that some teachers use your books in classrooms, and history, I guess, you know, some people say, I love history, but some people say, oh, history is boring. I don't want to read that. I don't want to do this. But because the way you write, it's a novel. It's a story. You describe the characters like Robert E. Lee. He had short legs, but sitting on that horse, he looked tall. And you would, you know, you just paint that picture. And all of a sudden, the reader is in Gettysburg. He's in the Oval Office with President Lincoln. He is sitting at the campfire smoking cigars. So this, I think, makes it easier, I guess, for high school kids to pick up books and read them.
Well, of course, you know, we're talking about a novel here. I mean, that's what I do. I write novels. And I recognize that a teacher who tries to use a novel to teach history is taking a big risk. And when I began to hear that the teachers were using my work, that adds enormously to the responsibility that I have to get it right. In other words, get the facts straight. Don't mess around with history. You know, make sure that the history is accurate so that the teacher can rely on that. But then the second part of that, being fiction, what makes my books fiction is you're in the heads of the characters. You're hearing dialogue. You're hearing their thoughts. Well, again, my research is painstaking on getting that right, because if I put words in the mouths of these significant historical characters, you know, characters that everybody knows, if I put words in their mouths that are counterfeit, that don't fit the character, that aren't authentic, not only will I know that, you will know that, and the book simply won't work. So, I mean, that's a huge part of my research, is for me to get to know these people on a personal level. But then what I've heard from the teachers is, if you can give a student a character that they can relate to and sort of get involved with and maybe like, they'll learn the history and not even realize they're learning the history. I mean, I love hearing that. I mean, this is not about names, dates, places, facts, and figures. it's about the people, and you'll learn the other stuff in spite of yourself.
We're visiting with award-winning New York Times bestselling author Jeff Shara. We're talking about his latest Civil War novel, and that's The Fateful Lightning. As we mentioned earlier, Jeff, the fact that 215 is the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, and most people don't realize, they think that it was a surrender at Appomattox Court, and the fact that that was it. Lee hands over his sword to General Grant. But there was a lot of fighting, and it was pretty violent there towards the end of the war.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people assume, and I mean, again, this is sort of the shorthand way that Civil War is taught in schools, that the war ends at Appomattox on April 9th, 1865, as you said, you know, when Lee surrenders to Grant. No, that's not correct. The war is still going on in the Carolinas. For 2.5 weeks later, General Joe Johnston, the Confederate general there, surrenders to Sherman. In Durham, North Carolina, that's the end of the war. And there actually are still some people in Texas who are insisting that the war is not over, and nothing really happens formally there. But for the most part, the war ends really not on April 9th. It ends on April 26th, and a lot of people don't know that. And I love that. I love telling you a story that you really don't know, and the drama around what happens there in Durham, North Carolina, is every bit as powerful as the drama of what happens at Appomattox, which is what makes my storytelling a great deal of fun.
In your novels, when we're hearing General Sherman talk or think aloud, he talks about giving gifts to President Lincoln and the fact that he's going to do that. And he delivers Georgia, and then he delivers Savannah in Christmas of 1864. So a lot of people don't think or put themselves in the fact of the war and Christmas and holidays. But these men were out there fighting brother against brother, cousin against cousin, and even on Christmas. And as General Sherman said, he was going to give the president a gift, and he did.
Well, yeah, there's the telegram. It's marvelous, and I quote it in the book, where, you know, Sherman is proud to present, you know, to the president, President Lincoln, the city, a Christmas gift of the city of Savannah. I mean, that conquest of Savannah, first of all, the reason that's significant is not just because of, you know, Sherman conquers Savannah. It's because for about a month and a half, nobody knows where Sherman is. When he leaves Atlanta and starts his march to the sea, he cuts himself off completely from any communication, any supply lines to the north. And so, and I love the quote from Abraham Lincoln where he says, "I know what hole he went down. I have no idea what hole he's going to come out of." I mean, they don't know where Sherman is going to suddenly appear. It's the United States Navy who is off, you know, the blockade of southern ports. The Navy's out there in the Atlantic Ocean. Suddenly they realize there are soldiers in blue along the shore, so it's the Navy that first sees Sherman's troops. And again, they have no idea where Sherman's going to show up, if he shows up at all. For all they know, Sherman has been crushed somewhere in Georgia. His army's been obliterated. They have no idea. So when he arrives in Savannah, the joyous surprise that he's able to send to Washington, D.C., that's really what he means by the gift of Savannah, is that, you know, his army has arrived, they've done the job, the campaign is successful, and that's a pretty nice feeling in Washington, D.C. Abraham Lincoln is thrilled.
We're visiting with Jeff Shara. He is a New York Times bestselling author and award-winning author of Civil War novels, World War II novels, the War of the Mexican-American War, and war about World War I, and then, of course, the other stories that he helped. His father wrote The Killer Angels, but then he wrote the prequel, Gods and Generals, and then Last Full Measure. When you write about World War II, especially the last one, which is what's called The Final Victory, is it?
The Final Storm.
Final Storm, okay. You tell us at the beginning of the book, you write about the fact that, you know, whether you agree or disagree with the dropping of the bomb or whatever happened here, it's not my job to put you in any direction, but I'm telling the story as it is. And because, as you say, you write it like a story, it reads very like a narrative, like a novel. People put themselves there, and all of a sudden, they're there, and they experience what the soldiers are experiencing, the tough decision that President Truman has to make, and, of course, you know, what happens after that bomb is dropped.
Well, it's very easy, and I run into this a lot, and it's something I criticize a lot. It's very easy for historians to look at history in hindsight. In other words, we know how it turned out. We know how the story ends, and so we go back and make judgments accordingly. That's not my job. I never do that. First of all, if you ever hear my voice in the story or my point of view or my opinion, whether it's about politics or religion or anything else, then I've done a really bad job, and I hope that never happens. But one great example, and you mentioned, you know, Truman, the agonizing decision whether to drop the atomic bomb, and boy, I have read so many contradictory things about, Truman agonized over it, he suffered the guilt and all this stuff. I'm sorry, I read his memoir. I have his memoirs. He doesn't have any guilt at all. He understands, much like we talked about Sherman, the idea of ending the war. Truman makes the decision to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima because he knows it'll end the war. Well, it takes a little while, and they have to drop a second bomb. But again, history in hindsight tells us, well, maybe they didn't have to drop the second bomb, so forth. At the time, nobody knew that. At the time, they're dealing with things. Nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow. And, you know, you go back to Normandy, the Normandy invasion, Dwight Eisenhower, you know, now we know, of course, you know, that started the beginning of the end for Nazi Germany. At the time, we had no idea. Eisenhower had no idea if his army was going to get thrown right back into the ocean. So that kind of uncertainty, the anxiety, the suspense of that, that's essential for me to include that in the story and not tell it from today's point of view.
Our listeners may be wondering, Jeff, what is Jeff Shara reading now? What does he like to read? And also, this is another question, where do you go from here that you've written the fourth saga of the Civil War?
Sure. Well, you know, I read typically 50 to 60 books for every book that I write, and it's all research. And most of it, wherever possible, the accounts of the people who were there. As I've said before, the diaries, the memoirs, the collections of letters. I mean, that's mainly what I read. Right now, I'm in the midst of starting a new set of research on Korea. I love the fact, I mean, if you ask most Americans what they know about the Korean War, they'll tell you MASH. Well,
yeah.
Okay, that's, you know, with all due respect to the people who did MASH, there really are some better stories. And when you have Incheon and the Chosin Reservoir and the Yalu River, and there are living veterans around Korea who very much feel ignored. They're overlooked. You know, the World War II veterans, of course, are getting all the attention because they're a little older and they're dying off at a huge rate, which is terrible. But the Korean vets have written me saying, hey, we're getting older too. And nobody has really told our story. And so that's very important to me. I'm very involved with that right now. I'll be working on that this fall and into next year. I'm very excited about the story because, again, it is a good story that almost no one knows.
Well, Jeff, we've had a great time visiting with you, and you do write some great stories, and we're looking forward to that next one. So thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.